On This Week in Enterprise Tech, contact tracing has been stirring the pot with privacy advocates. We're going to go through the latest there. Plus, have you ever wondered if attackers recycle their exploits? Think about that. Well, Curtis is going to enlighten us on those patterns. Plus, we have Joe Hillerstein, co-founder and CEO of Trifecta, to talk about data wrangling and data management. It's Wyatt on the set. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you from LastPass Studios. Stay in control when it comes to your company's access points and authentication. LastPass makes enterprise-level security simple for your remote workforce. Check out LastPass.com/twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twyatt. This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 393, recorded May 15th, 2020. The Once and Future Database. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by ExpressVPN. Now that a lot of you are working from home, it's even more important to choose a VPN you trust to protect you from online threats. For 3 extra months free with a 1-year package, go to expressvpn.com/enterprise. And by LastPass. Prepare for the unexpected in your business with LastPass, trusted by over 17 million users and 61,000 businesses worldwide. Visit LastPass.com/twit to find out how they can help you. And by Barracuda. Did you know that 91% of all cyber attacks start with an email? To uncover the threats hiding in your Office 365 account, get a secure and free email threat scan at barracuda.com/enterprise. Welcome to Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I'm your host, Louis Moreski, your guide through this big, giant world of the enterprise. But I definitely can't guide you by myself. I need to bring in the professionals, the experts in their field, starting with our very own geek in paradise and the guy who's busier today than he was yesterday, Mr. Brian Chi. Chibert, how's the world of weird connectivity solutions going?
You know, last week, when we were doing the show, I was going, every 10 minutes I was losing my connections, like really weird. It was a bad Ethernet adapter, darn. It's always a layer one problem, right?
That's right.
Anyway, the background I'm using is from the palace of Catherine the Great, and I thought I'd play around with some backgrounds.
Now, last week you were modernizing emergency call boxes, weren't you? What's going on this week?
Well, this week, unfortunately, I'm running a slight temperature and I've got kind of a phlegmy cough. No. So I'm keeping my distance from everybody to make sure it's not our friend COVID-19. I suspect it's just the fog in the air giving me problems. There's something about a volcano that's constantly erupting since the early 80s.
Take care of yourself and hopefully you'll feel better soon. Well, speaking of experts, we have our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin. He is the senior editor over there at Dark Reading. Curtis, always great to have you here from the Sunshine State. How's things going down there?
Well, we have no volcanoes whatsoever here in Florida, and we're very happy about that. So given the lack of volcanic activities, we're going to call it a great day. Sunshine, not too many clouds, and I had a great time. I got to introduce a young man to the joys of Arduino, and since he's talking about going to school to study computer science, I figure this is going to be some sort of important knowledge for him to have when he starts mixing it up with his fellow students in a few months.
Indeed it is. It will definitely be. Now, last week you broke some news. You told us that Black Hat and DEF CON was going to be online. Any more additional news from that front at all?
Well, they continue to do planning. They're not releasing a lot of very specific information because they're still putting some things together. I will say that I've heard some stuff behind the scenes, and I think what they're going to have is an absolutely incredible online conferencing experience. While nothing really compares to the face-to-face interaction that you can get, I think what they're going to be coming up with is something that is way ahead of what people think of right now when most of them consider the idea of a virtual conference. So I'm actually looking forward to it, and I know that I'm going to be playing a role in some of the sessions. So it should be an exciting time.
Sounds good. Looking forward to it. Well, it's been a busy week in the enterprise news, so we better get started here. So contact tracing has been stirring the pot with privacy advocates, and we're going to go through some of the latest there. Have you ever wondered if attackers actually recycle their exploits? Well, think about that for a second. And Curtis will take us through that and enlighten us a little bit. Plus, we have Joe Hellerstein, co-founder and CEO of Trifecta here to talk about data wrangling. But first, it's been a busy week in the enterprise, so let's go ahead and jump into this week's news blips. Now, over the last several years, there's been a trending number of improvements happening on the artificial intelligence front. In fact, I bet you would be surprised at all the things AI can do now that they couldn't do before. However, there still seems to be some things they can't do. What do you think? Can they learn some common sense? Well, there are researchers out there looking to find the answer to that. In fact, David Ferrucci, the builder of IBM's original Jeopardy playing version of Watson, has been looking for the silver bullet. Now, if common sense is basic knowledge that ordinary people possess, infusing it into AI possessing by necessity means engaging regular people and what they know, not just data scientists. Now, many AI companies are attempting to do this, but it isn't easy. Think about this test. An AI team provided an advanced language program the following sentence. Zoe moves her plant to a sunny window and soon, dot, dot, dot. Now, the AI program was tasked to complete that second sentence, but a human would most likely complete the sentence by saying, well, the sun will help the plant to grow and stay healthy. In the real world, it's common knowledge that plants need light to grow. Unfortunately, the AI program couldn't deliver this common observation. Instead, the AI completed the sentence by analyzing statistical patterns, and it came up with these possible answers. She finds something not pleasant, or fertilizer is visible in the window, or another plant is missing from the bedroom. Now, seeing not an easy task to state the obvious, but the industry, however, is still getting good use of AI, even though it can't have common sense just yet. In fact, they know AI isn't perfect, but they have found ways to make it useful, keeping them competitive. And most organizations retain human experts as well that can frequently verify the validity of AI results and the ability to override behaviors if they aren't correct. In fact, companies must find the right mix of common sense and uncommon results that they want from their AI, and experimenting will continue to help achieve that balance. This means AI still has a long way to go before the overlords take over.
Well, a new project aims to unmask disinformation bots. A research team published plugins for major web browsers on Thursday that gave users a score as to the likelihood that a Twitter handle is a bot or a human. Dubbed BotSight, the project is the brainchild of machine learning researchers at security firm NortonLifeLock, formerly a subsidiary of Symantec, which aims to help users determine which accounts are valid and which are not. The tool uses 4 terabytes of data collected by the researchers over the past 6 months and looks at 20 features ranging from the randomness of the Twitter handle to the rate of follower acquisition to classify the handle as a bot or a human. The BotSight plugins insert a human or bot icon next to each Twitter handle, along with color indicating whether the algorithm believes the account to be human, green, or bot, red, as well as a measure of confidence. However, identifying Twitter bots is not the same as identifying the source of disinformation, since bots typically only relay or amplify information. Bot Sentinel, a project that attempts to identify untrustworthy Twitter accounts and troll bots using a machine learning model built from some 5 million tweets. Such tools can help users better gauge which information online can be trusted and which should be taken with a large block of salt.
This story is, wow. Failure to delete some hate speech could cost Facebook and Google billions in France. Lawmakers in France this week passed a controversial new law that could impose billions in fines on social media companies that fail to delete certain kinds of content quickly enough and within an hour in some cases. The new legislation gives online platforms 24 hours from notification to remove certain kinds of content or else face fines. content subject to enforcement under the law includes sexual harassment, child pornography, anything that promotes certain crimes, anything that promotes discrimination, hate, or violence, anything that denies crimes against humanity, and promotion of terrorism. The window for removing content related to child pornography or terrorism is shorter, only 1 hour. A company that fails to remove such content within the correct time limit after being notified of it can be fined 1.25 million euros, about $1.35 million US. If a regulatory board finds a company is not meeting its obligations, it can impose a maximum fine equal to 4% of that company's annual global revenue. So, for a sense of scale, Facebook's total revenue for calendar year 2019 was about $70.6 billion US. So 4% of that would be $2.8 billion. Alphabet's global revenue for the same period was about $162 billion US, 4% of which would be about $6.5 billion. Oh, wow. This is basically telling me that France is really taking the GDPR and certain concepts similar to that a whole heck of a lot further.
Now, Node.js has been around for a while. It's released back in 2009, and it allowed developers to execute JavaScript outside a browser. And from there, things just kind of took off. Now, Node.js combines Google's V8 JavaScript engine and event loop and a low-level I/O API to create the environment. And the creator, Ryan Dahl, has always been surprised in how fast the popularity of Node took off and how the entire ecosystem and industry was built around it. But server-side and client-side has taken advantage of Node.js. In fact, he hasn't been always happy with some of the original design decisions he made and they made on it that have actually persisted through the years, and he has been looking for ways to reconcile it since then, until now. Hence the debut of Dino 1.0. Now, with the changing JavaScript language and new additions like TypeScript, building Node projects can become difficult tasks involving managed build systems and other heavy-handed tooling that takes away from the fun of dynamic language scripting. Now, the mechanism for linking to external libraries is fundamentally centralized through NPM repositories, which could be complex for web's agility. Now, Dino is a new runtime for executing JavaScript and TypeScript outside the web browser. Now, it attempts to provide a standalone tool for quickly scripting complex functionality. Dino is and always will be just a single executable file, and like a browser, it knows how to fetch external code. In fact, in it, a single file can define arbitrarily complex behavior without any other tooling by itself, and it starts with consent first. So, to add a layer of security when attempting to access sensitive resources. Kind of compared to how browsers ask you if it's okay to access your location or your webcam today. Plus, Dino is careful to not deviate from standardized browser JavaScript APIs. In fact, one of the coolest things here that I find pretty cool is that Dino has first-class support for TypeScript without additional tooling. That's right. It was built for performance too. Now check out the Hello World. Now Hello World Dino HTTP server does about 25,000 requests per second with a max latency of 1.3 milliseconds. Now comparably, Node program does about 34,000 requests per second with a rather erratic max latency between 2 and 300 milliseconds. So if you're looking for a way to better make use of your Node code and even make it more performant and reliable and find ways to scale and modernize it, Dino might be the ticket to your success.
Well, there's a new cyber espionage framework in town, and it's called RAMSI. Researchers have found a new cyber espionage framework developed to collect and exfiltrate sensitive files from air-gapped networks not connected to the internet. This framework, called RAMSI, has gone through several iterations as its developers test new approaches to attack. Cybersecurity firm ESET discovered its first RAMSI components earlier this year when a file uploaded to VirusTotal caught its attention. ESET telemetry shows RAMSI only has a small pool of victims. This reinforces the team's belief that the framework is still in development. However, the low visibility of victims could also be attributed to the discovery that RAMSI's targeted systems are in air-gapped networks not connected to the internet. So far, it's clear that RAMSI is a new form of malware. It's unclear precisely who is behind it. The fact that it's designed to operate without internet connectivity indicates it's built to be used in highly restricted environments or air-gapped systems, which typically protect high-value information. The framework is built to run for a long period of time, during which it monitors removable drives and network shares for new documents to steal until an exfiltration can happen. Ramsey's primary goal is to collect all existing Microsoft Word documents on a target file system. Ramsey developers in charge of attacking vectors seem to be trying different techniques, researchers found, such as old exploits for Windows flaws from 2017, as well as deployment of malicious applications delivered via spear phishing emails.
Oh, that's really scary. Anyway, our friend has found a Google app loophole. Just keep re-releasing old devices. Huawei is still struggling to cope with the Trump administration's U.S. export ban, which blocks U.S. companies from doing business with the Chinese company. While Huawei can be pretty independent as far as hardware goes, the loss of Google's software is basically going to kill Huawei's phone business outside of China. The company is already expecting a 20% drop in phone sales in 2020, and thanks to the yearly life cycle of smartphones, a lot of Google Huawei phones are still on the market, so we're seeing only the beginnings of the effect on the with the export ban. Huawei is doing its best to delay the effects of the export ban, though, and lately it seems to have come up with a new loophole to keep shipping the Google apps, re-release old smartphones. The way the export ban has worked in practice is that Huawei devices that launched before the export ban and some that launched just slightly afterwards can still be sold with Google apps. Devices that launched well after the ban, like the Mate 30 Pro, are stuck without the Google apps. So Huawei's solution and its interpretation of law is that re-release of old devices can still ship with Google apps.
So the Patriot Act always caused people to worry just how far the government agencies can go without cause to actually invade someone's privacy. Now, it gives a government agency power to carry out mass electronic surveillance of U.S. citizens. Now, as a small stepping stone to potentially get back there, the U.S. Senate recently voted by a single vote to allow government agencies like the FBI and the CIA to access your browser history without a warrant. So this means they would not need to show probable cause for believing you have committed a crime before requiring your ISP to hand over your records on your web browsing and search histories. Now, however, there is a possible saving grace here. Now, if you use a VPN that provides protection against this kind of surveillance, and it means your ISP would have no way to know which websites you actually visited. Now, there's some good news here. A Second Amendment did pass, which allows judges to rule on Foreign Intelligence Service Act, the FISA Act, requires to actually seek input from independent experts. Now, a Third Amendment actually requires warrants to carry out FISA searches on U.S. citizens and is due to be voted soon. So let's hope that goes through. I guess in the meantime, the best course of action is if you're worrying about your privacy and security of your data, get yourself a VPN. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, the bites. But before we get to those bites, we have to thank a great sponsor of this week in Enterprise Tech. And it's actually a really good one because it's ExpressVPN. That's right. ExpressVPN is the software that I and thousands of my fans use every day to protect our data online. And since I started using ExpressVPN, hacking methods have grown even more sophisticated. And I'm sure many of you are working from home these days. And without our IT departments to protect us from online threats, it's important that you take action on your own secure devices for your work use. And that's why I recommend using ExpressVPN for the best online protection possible. That's right. I've been talking about ExpressVPN for a long time, so long that you already understand when encrypting your network is important. But sometimes, for some reason, some of you still haven't acted. Why is that? Well, you might be thinking, well, that security threats don't affect me personally. But not using ExpressVPN is like leaving your front door unlocked every time you go out. And my family does this and it drives me crazy. We don't live in Mayberry and we can't be leaving the door unlocked. So sure, nothing might happen for years, but when breaking in does happen, it's devastating. Now, one of the easiest ways to secure your internet data is with ExpressVPN. You click one button on your computer or smartphone and you are protected. Just one button. It's really that simple. So try it out. So my only question is, Why haven't you gotten ExpressVPN yet? Visit my special link right now, expressvpn.com/enterprise, and get an extra 3 months of ExpressVPN for free with 1 year package. Protect your internet today with the VPN I trust to keep my data safe. That's expressvpn.com/enterprise. And we thank ExpressVPN for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's now time for the bites. Now, tech-enhanced COVID-19 contact tracing holds great promise for both public health officials, politicians, and app developers alike. But with great data collection comes great responsibility, people and experts alike worrying that without proper planning, today's decisions about developing contact tracing apps could have unforeseen consequences for years to come. Now, the analog way or the analog version of this is that public health officials track infectious diseases as common as tuberculosis or as lethal as Ebola, stop their spread using manual contact tracing mechanisms. It requires boots on the ground, people tracking down patients and interviewing them about where they've been or who they've actually met with. And then they find those people and let them know that are in contact with someone who has been positive. And it's, you know, on from there. Now, if any of them have tested positive, their contacts must also be interviewed and so on and so forth. Now, this is why a technological way will really scale the efforts. Now, there are many ideas and concepts out there and implementations worldwide. Now, we've talked about Google and Apple's way of doing it. Now, they will use, they're attempting to use automatic Bluetooth interactions between phones to synonymously actually identify when a person has come in proximity to an infected patient. Now, for now, they're not making their own apps, but building the cross-platform architecture that contact tracing app developers can use. Now, it seems like each country and government out there, agency, is actually looking for programs as well. In fact, a lot of them have proposals or actually developed some programs here. Now, Taiwan's contact tracing program has been hailed as a possible model for the United States. China's program would be considered invasive by the Western standards. Meanwhile, Israel is involuntarily collecting geolocation data. Singapore has built an open source contact tracing system based on Bluetooth beacons, and the United Kingdom is struggling to find its own way. So this has privacy advocates and technologists weary of whether they or well, those risks here in privacy. Now, the data and contact tracing apps could collect, could we go actually go well beyond where the device owner has been. In fact, it could include health and healthcare information, government identification numbers, and infection status, all of which could be abused by hackers. Now, lots of studies and programs are going on to determine how best to allow users to be in control of their data. In fact, a study on creating privacy-sensitive protocols for mobile device contact tracing, or PACT, co-authored by researchers from Microsoft, the University of Washington, the University of Pennsylvania, and the Boston Public Health Commission, actually recommend that location data be kept locally on the device and only used in efforts to identify who else was near the infected patient and who might be safe or might not be safe from exploitation. So I want to bring my co-host in. Curtis, first thing, we talked about this before, but none of the methods will be useful unless really either everyone is using it or another means. What else can help here if it's not everyone's using it?
Well, you can start to get some very broad numbers around something, and you can probably pick out some pockets. But it's true. This is like pretty much any network or network application. Its value goes up as the number of nodes increase. And as the number of nodes start to get toward the number of residents of a population, the value gets very high indeed. The problem with this is that we're asking people to opt in, and as we pointed out, not everyone will. So I think it's one of those great debates that this pandemic has brought about, is the value of the data, is the ability to trace contacts, more important than the privacy issues around an app or the government or a government app collecting the data? And that the answer to that's going to vary from individual to individual. What else could we do around this? It's hard to know unless it's something like the stand-up apps that are on your watches and phones that remind you to stand up every hour. I suppose if we had an app that reminded you to put on a mask, stay home, sit down, shut up, you know, once an hour or so, that might have an impact. But this is one where, barring some sort of wide government-ordered mass data collection, it's hard to see how the value is going to come anywhere close to what the developers hope it will be.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's been a lot of speculation on whether if they combined the app with, you know, people who are opted into using it with maybe, you know, traditional manual contact tracing would help. But again, that could require a massive amount of effort and capital to be able to produce that. So that should be interesting to see if they go anywhere with that. Chiebert, you know, some people are working on this, right?
Yep. I am under a non-disclosure, but basically the information that I can share is that the efforts that have gone into making sure that even if someone did grab the information, that it would be next to useless to them. So everybody has a randomly assigned, well, when they sign up, a randomly assigned ID. When you get next to people, all it does is keep track of what people you've come in contact with, only their IDs, none other information. Keeping in mind that both Apple and Google, neither of them can get access to even that much data. Now, if a healthcare provider says, I'm sorry, you know, Jane Doe, you have COVID-19. They can get the ID from Jane Doe, submit that through the healthcare network, which then goes out and sends the information, and it will only send it to the people that it has tagged as Jane Doe has come in contact with, and gives them the opportunity to have a pop-up and say, hey, you might want to go and get checked. We think you've come in contact with someone, and they won't even tell you who. It's just that you may have come in contact. We suggest you get tested. Now, keep in mind, this is really, really, really different from what's in Taiwan. Taiwan actually sends PII because it's tied into their national healthcare app. Same thing with Israel and various other people. The UK is looking at something that's actually quite intrusive and so forth and so on. And the Chinese version is, you know, basically they go, I'm sorry, we know who you are. Please come in. If you don't come in, you are going to be grabbed. So there's a lot of different ways of doing this, but you can't argue with the results. So the really, really, really big debate is, are we willing to give up even a little bit of our privacy so that we can actually survive this pandemic? And I keep reminding people that the Bill of Rights is not a suicide pact. So sometimes, when things happen, you know, that's what martial law is about. They're actually having to suspend a few of your rights in order for the greater good. Lots of people argue against this. In a previous story that I've covered in the past, the survey came out saying at best, we're looking at 50% of the population opting in. So Taiwan basically forced it on people. Israel forced it on people. China forced it on people. And we've seen how well that's worked. I'd be really interested to find out a little bit more of how New Zealand has done it, because I don't think the amount of manpower necessary to trace down the number of contacts a person has, especially since there's a lot of people where you have no idea you came in contact with someone. You know, it might be, you know, John Doe flipping burgers at the place you had takeout from. And somehow or another, someone goofed and they weren't wearing gloves when they grabbed the burger box and you caught it. I don't know. This is going to be really, really interesting. And the civil rights people are using this as a watermark case. How will the general public react? We don't know until it's actually out there. Right. From what I understand, it's in beta right now, and I've actually sent out queries on how I can get onto that beta group, because I believe that I really and truly would like not to get COVID-19.
Indeed. Now, I'm glad you brought it up because you said, hey, you know, you have to sometimes give up a little bit of your privacy to potentially make this useful. So the interesting thing here is that we are seeing some implementations like India's contact tracing app. They have lots of privacy issues, but they have over 100 million users. That's not downloads. It's actually users. So I want to throw that back to you, Cheaper. What do you think? Do you think this is just because they're seeing the fruits of that app working, of that service working, or is it fear?
Probably a little bit of both. I'm not going to second guess these people. I do not have a degree in public health, nor do I have a degree in epidemiology. But I have participated in exercises. You will be glad to know your federal government does do exercise. We do pandemic training. It's not all the time, but I have participated in two during my career. Mm-hmm. And the reality is there's a lot of scenarios out there that we actually have one with the colloquial term of dumb fill in the blank, where we had a massive stadium concert and several, you know, dozens of people that were highly infected. In this case, it was a smallpox exercise. Infected a large number of the people in that stadium and created we almost called it a wildfire situation across the United States. And I watched how fast the red on the U.S. map filled in, and it was absolutely frightening. So I'm hoping people will see and be willing to give up just a shade of their privacy, at least during this pandemic. Once everything's done and the all clear has been given, delete the app. You know, that's what's nice about an opt-in. Otherwise, if it's mandatory and it gets really bad and becomes mandatory, we may have something like what Taiwan or China has. And I'm not sure I really like that idea.
All right, well, that's enough of that. Let's jump into something a little bit more interesting in my book. I think I've always wondered whether attackers recycle their exploits. Curtis, do they?
Oh, absolutely. We know from long experience that cyber criminals not only recycle exploits, they are like everyone else doing code development. They recycle code. They use code snippets. They bring in old things. Why? Well, like the best businesses, they're both lazy and cheap. And what researchers are finding that these cyber attackers are routinely using older vulnerabilities to exploit businesses. In some cases, they have found that they're using vulnerabilities that are more than 5 years old to compromise companies and organizations today. And on May 12th, CISA, the government Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, FBI, and other U.S. government cybersecurity responders warn companies and agencies that publicly known vulnerabilities are far more commonly targeted by nation-state, cyber criminal, and unattributed attackers than zero-day vulnerabilities. We all get very excited about zero days. But when it comes down in the pantheon of things to worry about, actually pretty low on the list. What does this mean? It means that failure to patch vulnerabilities. And in the research that they did, everything they warned about was more than a year old, puts organizations at significantly higher risk of compromise. Now, they found that both public and private sectors could degrade some foreign cyber threats to U.S. interests simply by implementing an increased effort to patch their systems. How hard is it to patch the systems? You know, here at Twiat, you've heard us talk about this over and over and over again. Seems like each of us has said something like, patch your systems during multiple blips, bytes, and conversations with guests. Patching is the most basic way that companies can improve their cybersecurity posture. However, old versions of software still exist in many IT environments. The problems with patching are highlighted by the fact that one vulnerability on the CISA's top 10 list of commonly exploited vulnerabilities was first disclosed in 2012. I mean, think about it. We have a vulnerability that's now in the second grade, and it's still in the top 10 list of most exploited vulnerabilities. The advisory that came out this week also warned that moving to remote working during the coronavirus pandemic has resulted in additional cybersecurity weaknesses. Are attackers laying off these weaknesses out of the goodness of their hearts? No, they are not. They are taking advantage of these and hitting them hard in multiple ways. March 2020 brought an abrupt shift to work from home rules, regulations, practices, everything. And it necessitated for many organizations rapid deployment of cloud collaboration services. You know, as an example, Microsoft Office 365 and the Google Gmail suite. Malicious cyber actors are targeting organizations whose hasty deployment of Office 365 might have led to oversights in security configurations and therefore a vulnerability to attack. Now, we've talked about Microsoft, and if you look at the list, there are a lot of Microsoft vulnerabilities on the list. Why? Because Microsoft products are very, very popular. It's an old joke made by an American gangster back in the 30s. Someone asked him why he robs banks. That's where they keep the money, he said. Why do people attack Microsoft products? Because those are the products people use. Seven of the top 10 vulnerabilities are in Microsoft Office, SharePoint, Windows, the .NET framework. Microsoft's method of sharing data between all of these different products and platforms, which is known as object linking and embedding, or OLE, is a common target from attackers. And the top three vulnerabilities targeted by state-sponsored cyber actors from China, Iran, and North Korea and Russia are all related to this technology. You know, there can be significant costs to redeveloping applications. There can be significant costs to updating applications. There can be significant costs to retraining employees to use updated applications. Known, noted. The thing is, there are significant risks to not doing these things. And there can be significant benefits beyond the fact that they're less exploitable. In general, the software brings improved performance and enhanced features. So here, and I'm going to be a little bit disingenuous because, Lou, I'm going to come to you. Are you surprised when you hear that so many organizations are still using versions of software and operating systems that are between 5 and 10 years old?
It's interesting because, you know, if I put it my kind of software developer engineering hat on and privacy security enthusiast feelings, I can say, no, I'm actually very surprised that they're still doing it. But if you look at it from a customer perspective, a lot of organizations, they have developed solutions. You know, they spent millions, sometimes millions of dollars developing solutions for their organization, whether it's building software, whether it's building extensions on software, whether it's just deploying solutions to their organization. And those solutions work. They work fine. They continue to work. Sometimes they are even just on-premise solutions that they feel secure enough. And so when it comes time to determine whether they should upgrade or not, they evaluate the costs. And sometimes the cost is, you know, that plus the original cost they had implemented and deployed originally. And they haven't really seen any risk to what they've actually implemented or deployed. So that seems to be a lot of the push behind a lot of this. But now you're getting CIOs, CSOs, CTOs into the system that are saying, no. Like, let's go just go figure out what it's going to cost and we'll put it in the budget and we'll go do it. And again, a lot of services and software out there today is trying to get people more on to the service deployed or constantly incrementally updating things. Like, for instance, that's the whole idea between the Microsoft's Microsoft 365 or Office 365 mechanism, which is you get on that and it's just a train. And as the train goes, you'll just frequently get updates, patches, and so on that not only improve the experience and add features, but also security. But again, that doesn't apply to a lot of other software that's out in the wild today. So like you could have a really old version of Office, like 2003. And again, unless you're patching it and keeping it up to date, it could be vulnerable. And so am I surprised? I guess from a software developer perspective, yes. Like, why wouldn't you want to make your organization secure, please? But am I surprised from an implementation perspective? Not really.
Well, let me ask you a follow-up question. You know, in this news piece, it talked about OLE, and we know that there are lots and lots of APIs, bits and pieces of SDKs that are in use around any corporation software. I mean, you can look at Microsoft, you can look at Oracle, Salesforce, Google, name one. These things change over time. But from where you sit, when you talk about enterprise software, enterprise applications, homegrown enterprise applications, when these APIs, SDKs, other bits and pieces of interface and software are updated, do they typically come with massive changes that would be required in a homegrown application, or is that something that's kind of overblown on a routine basis?
They don't necessarily come with large changes. Like OLE, I'll give you an example. One of my teams owns Access. So one of my engineering teams maintains Access. And so there's the old OLE DB interfaces that allow you to interact with a database. Those interfaces haven't changed for a very, very long time. Now, the interfaces don't have to change. If we think about it from modern services perspective, you implement a microservice that has an API or an interface, and that interface doesn't have to change. You just keep interacting with it, and you can proxy to other services and do other things under the covers. And that's kind of what OLE does, is even though over the years it's been patched and features have been added and performance changes and security changes, the interfaces haven't changed or haven't needed to change, but it's still useful. People still ship applications that interact with the Access runtime with it, and they, as long as they're continuing to run Windows Update and making the getting security and feature patches, they're fine. And I think it's a misnomer sometimes to say if I upgrade or update that interfaces are going to change. I mean, it's going to force me to break. I think I've had many of discussions over the 16 years in the software business to say that, like, we shouldn't be changing these on customers. They want to continue reliability with our software. So if we're adding features, we just need to add different interfaces. And if they take advantage of it when they want to. And that's been a pretty big pattern that we've followed over the years. So that's why a lot of organizations stay fairly reliable, have reliable solutions for such a long time. And this goes even with Windows interfaces and .NET interfaces and JavaScript and Node interfaces and you name it. And so even web browser, web view interfaces. So I think that, it's a misnomer to say that upgrading is going to change things. But I do think that you'd also have to make sure you update the components that own those interfaces.
Well, just real quickly, I want to turn to Brian and ask, you have come at this from a different angle, supporting end users and their departments and organizations. How big a set of resistance have you found to groups wanting to update? Is it really like pulling teeth? Or, again, is the idea that organizations don't want to update something that is sort of a straw man? Are most organizations out there doing the right thing on a regular basis?
For the most part, when I see people using regular workstations, regular servers, and so forth, updating hasn't been a real big problem. It's the embedded stuff, the special purpose machines. Like I ran into an orthopedic exercise. Well, it's an orthopedic exercise type of equipment. It measures leg extensions after someone's injured their knee. It was actually at a athletic complex, and that's still running Windows 95, which is really, really frightening. But the problem is they can't change it because the company's gone out of business and the equipment itself was so expensive, they can't afford to change it. I see the same thing with specialized equipment like gas pumps. I still see Windows XP embedded at gas pumps when I see them booting up. So the reality is, in my mind, is yeah, we're still going to have a lot of stuff. So what I've been doing in those cases when I know that exists is I start zoning them off and putting a lot more IDS IPS on there. In fact, one of our fans actually started asking me about this type of things. And I said, you know, most firewalls are capable, most enterprise firewalls are capable of doing zones, no problem at all. And so what I do is I just attach zones to a VLAN. And sometimes if I have a really high risk public thing, I will actually go and zone off even a single subnet, you know, chop it up and, you know, move it around so that I have the ability to assign IPS IDS so I can look at 100% of the data going back and forth just in case someone's managed to punch a lock on a gas pump. It's, I wouldn't say hard, you know, this is something that a lot of these enterprise firewalls can do just right out of the box, and the licensing is not horrible, but you know, it needs to be done. You need to do something. It's got to give. You know, if you've got, if you're backed against the corner and you can't upgrade, you need to do something else. And my answer is zones. I'm my home firewall actually has a dozen zones on it.
Well, it's interesting that you've got problems, you've got solutions, and fortunately this is brand new, so we'll probably never have to talk about it again. No, this is the kind of thing that's been around a while, and you can bet that we'll have at least one more conversation about this probably this calendar year. Yeah, it's that kind of problem. Well, for different kinds of solutions and no problems whatsoever, I'm going to toss it back to Lou for, I'm suspecting, another call out to a sponsor and a really great guest we're waiting to get to.
Thanks, Curtis. That's great. We do have a great sponsor, and that's LastPass. Now, it's always important to have a plan for the unexpected, right? Well, LastPass helps you plan. Now, people have their favorite tool that saves them time and money, and I get things done, and mine is definitely LastPass. I love LastPass. In fact, I've used LastPass so often, I don't even know I'm using it anymore. It's my favorite tool. Think about it. You have a username and password for every site you go to, especially the most important ones that you find most important. Like, for instance, your financial sites and your business sites and your social networks, your email, you name it. You have a password, unique password for every one of them. And it's so hard to remember all those. So LastPass jumps in and saves you by auto-filling those passwords for you. All you have to do is remember your master password, and LastPass remembers the rest. In fact, I've actually integrated with Active Directory, so now I only have to remember my one password that I use for the network login, and I get access to my credentials as well. So great, so great. Now, in fact, I started using LastPass Authenticator, and it literally saved me because I broke my phone, and all of those multi-factor tokens were on it that I used to register on the device. Now, with LastPass Authenticator's new cloud backup feature, you can restore your multi-factor tokens if you lose or upgrade your phone. And I thought I was going to be locked out, but instead, I was saved thanks to LastPass. For businesses, LastPass is an amazing solution because it not only ensures better security practices, but makes things more efficient. Now, LastPass can be deployed quickly in the midst of any event to ensure your business keeps running smoothly and every employee login is secure. Now, single sign-on manages employee access in a centralized view. So actually, your IT always has insight into who has access to what and from where. And enterprise password management ensures oversight of shadow IT and enforceable policies across all password protected accounts. And multi-factor authentication requires additional factors to prove a user's identity, while the use of biometric and contextual factors make the process smooth for employees. Now, businesses should be thinking about additional layers of defense beyond the password, and LastPass does too. Now, LastPass does not send or store your master password. Now, if LastPass can't access your data, hackers can't either. Now, encryption happens exclusively at the device level before syncing LastPass for safe storage. So only users can decrypt their data. And they use 256-bit AES encryption. That is the same encryption type utilized by the banks and military. So you know it's secure. Now, LastPass protects while providing a seamless workflow for you and your employees. Account access and passwords can be shared securely between employees, whether they're in your office or they're out there. We're working remotely right now. Now, employees will get secure access to their own work applications with single sign-on and password management, and there's an offline mode. So for you can actually manage your passwords and multi-factor authentication offline, so employees can always access what they need when they need to. Now, if it sounds like LastPass has considered it all for security and productivity, then you'd be hearing right. LastPass can help make remote work simple and secure. Visit LastPass.com/twit to find out how they can help your business stay productive and secure no matter what. That's LastPass.com/twit. And we thank LastPass for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's my favorite part of the show where we get to bring a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Ryan. Today we have Joe Hellerstein, co-founder and CSO of Trifacta. Honored to have you on the show, Joe. Thanks so much for being here.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Now, our audience loves to hear people's journey through tech. Can you take us on a short journey of how you ended up co-founding Trifacta?
Yeah, well, it'd be a long story if I go all the way back. I'm a professor of computer science at UC Berkeley, so why don't we start there? Been involved in data management and all the things around it, so user experience and machine learning and security, just anything you can imagine around data, teaching and doing research at Berkeley since the mid-90s. And a sort of persistent problem that we were working on during that time is how do people spend their time when they're working with data? Particularly folks who have real jobs to do and don't want to spend all their time just banging around with data, but actually have other jobs, marketing, public health, for example. How do we get those people productive? And what we found talking to users over and over was that they spend all their time wrangling their data, trying to get it in the right format, trying to get it put together from multiple sources, trying to get it into a rectangle so they could put it in a spreadsheet or a table. And so some years ago, we set out to look and see if we could use new techniques in AI, in human-computer interaction, and in databases to solve this problem and make it easy and fun for people. And we built a research prototype called Wrangler, and we posted it up at a website at Stanford. I'm sorry to say, as a Berkeley professor, it was a collaboration with friends at Stanford. So the original version was posted there, and we had tens of thousands of people using it right away because we'd really changed the rules for who and how you work with data. And based on that, we went and we started a company called Trifacta to take that technology off of campus and turn it into something bulletproof, scalable, and well integrated into, you know, the software stacks of today and tomorrow. So Trifacta is the company that emerged from that research at Berkeley and Stanford.
Fantastic. Now, first, I want to commend you. I love the new series, Data School with Professor Joe Hellerstein. Data wrangling, user experience, scaling big data. Love it all. So good. I actually have people go check that out. We'll have to talk about that in a little bit because we might have to pick your brain in some of that stuff. But so we heard a little bit of your motivations for developing and producing Trifacta. Maybe we can get into some of the challenges we see that organizations are kind of running into today. Because a lot of big data, we talk about a lot of big data, people moving data from on-prem, not the cloud, and they just have different heterogeneous pieces of data out there. How are organizations handling this?
Well, I mean, it's such a sea change since the days of, enterprise data warehouses and the central source of truth, right? There's no central source of truth in the world. We get so much data from so many places. Your thermometer and your employee database have little to do with each other, and they have different kinds of curation, right? So mm-hmm. When we think about a data strategy for a modern enterprise, take a healthcare organization, for example. They've got clinical trials data from scientists. They've got traditional enterprise data like HR data. They've got patient data. They've got so many different things. You can't ask them to jam it all into a database. And this is where the whole notion of data lakes arose. The idea that, okay, well, let's get the data physically into one place. And we'll worry about integrating it later. And, this started out in the enterprise with open source solutions for big data like Hadoop and the Hadoop file system. But it's really become accessible and taken off in the cloud because de facto, the cheapest way to store data in the cloud is in the big object stores. So think of things like Amazon S3. This is where data just goes in the cloud because that's the inexpensive place to put it. So now we got the data in one place. The bits are there. And the challenge is the one we really want to look at, which is how do I put this stuff together in a meaningful sense, not getting the wires between the pieces of software together, but actually getting the data and kind of massaging it like clay on a potter's wheel so that we can make it into the shape we need for our use.
Right. And now, you've kind of pointed out a lot of organizations have this data. They centralize the data so they can potentially easily query it, analyze it, produce insights on it, so they don't have to go out and spread that querying across many different stores. What processes are you seeing on these kind of data lakes, these big data decentralized stores, or what are organizations doing to actually produce insights from it?
Well, I think what we're seeing is actually a healthy diversity of the ways people are doing stuff. One example I think that's kind of heartening is the rise of the cloud data warehouse. So I sort of made a little bit of gentle fun a minute ago about the idea from the 90s of the single source of truth data warehouse. Mm-hmm. But what we're seeing in the cloud is that you do want to integrate a lot of data that's useful to the business in one sort of clean place where you can do analysis. And that starts to look something like a traditional data warehouse. But we want this fluidity to get the data in easily and land it before we sort of schematize it, register it. So it's really interesting to see how data flows from files into sort of data wrangling software to straighten it out and then loading up into data warehouses. Think of things like Snowflake or Redshift on Amazon, right? So those are examples. But there's also very different examples where we're seeing raw data that gets cleaned up and put right into visualization tools or reports. We see integrations of software, of application software, right, where you're taking raw data from one place and it's driving, for instance, recommenders and machine learning and live web apps. And so the diversity of these use cases is what's so exciting and what's enabled by having that centralized storage and then many ways to wrangle your data outwards into different use cases.
Right. I think the interesting thing here is we see a lot of organizations they'll still keep their data in the place that it, started out, but then they actually produce data analytics off of it and then they stick it in these warehouses for reporting and so on. Are we seeing that there's a rise of costs when this happens? Are we seeing a change in how things are? Obviously, data is continuing to flow in and they're continuing to do analytics. How is cost changing for organizations?
I think on the whole, cost is going down, and you have to look at the big picture. So back in the day, what would happen is there'd be a very expensive design process inside of IT to sort of try to figure out the data flows to get them schematized into that one single source of truth, loaded into that big expensive piece of iron, and then reports would get written, right? But what also happened, and it was seen much less, you guys talked about shadow IT a minute ago, is all those SQL Server databases and Excel and Access databases under the desktop that were replicating that data like bunnies, and the desktop tools that were being sold to work in that environment. So there were little data wrangling tools that would run on the desktop to take things, from your local SQL Server cut of the data from 6 months ago and load it into a Tableau visualization. So all of that ancillary work that was happening kind of in the background on desktops and under desks, that stuff starts to go away as we move to the cloud. So in the cloud, of course, we're paying for things hopefully as we use it and not paying for so much CapEx, capital expenses for equipment. But moreover, what we're doing is we're getting software that's more directly connected to the sources of the data. The sinks and the sources are closer. And we've got less of this ancillary sort of stuff floating around that we're paying for and almost not even noticing because it's outside of IT.
Right. Well, when we come back, we have a lot more to talk about here, especially data management and other things, and I'll bring my co-host back in. But before we do, I have to thank another great sponsor of this week in enterprise tech, and that is Barracuda. Now, Barracuda is the provider of a cloud-enabled enterprise-grade security solutions that protect email, networks, data, and applications. Think about it. Suddenly, you have dozens, hundreds, or maybe thousands of employees working remotely right now. Each one of them getting tons of emails every day, making them actually vulnerable. Now, 91% of all cyber attacks start in an email. spear phishing, ransomware, account takeovers, in fact, even conversation hijacking. Multiply that by how many employees you have. Now times that how many emails. One click on the wrong email can actually cost you money, customers, and your company and organization's reputation. Now, Barracuda's researchers have seen a steady increase in the number of coronavirus-related spear phishing attacks since January, and they've observed a recent spike of 667% in this type of attack since the end of February. Now, get the protection you need for companies with Barracuda Total Email Protection. Now, guess what it includes? It includes all-in-one email security, backup, and archiving, AI-based protection for spear phishing and account takeovers, and business email compromise, and automated incident response that gives you options to quickly and efficiently address attacks. Now, security awareness training to actually help you educate your workforce so your employees can be the first line of defense against attacks. Now, we've covered a lot of the times, a lot of these different stories on TWiET in the past. Now, in the current climate, the bad guys are targeting people using social engineering techniques. They impersonate world organizations like the UN World Health Organization and U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to trick users into opening a malicious email, and then users access the malicious coded site, and that's it. Their devices are now attackers. Now it's time to take back control of your security. Ensure the safety and security of your business with Barracuda. To uncover the threats hiding in your inbox, get a secure, free email threat scan of your Office 365 account risk-free at barracuda.com/enterprise. That's barracuda.com/enterprise. Barracuda, your journey secured. And we thank Barracuda for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, we talked with Joe Hellerstein, co-founder and CSO of Trifecta. Joe, thanks so much for being here. We've been talking a little about how organizations are storing data and transferring data and potentially creating analytics off the data. But what about just managing that data? Like, well, we're seeing obviously different devices out there today and different sources of data. How are they managing things, and how has it changed over time?
Yeah, I think that's a story that's still evolving, to be honest. When you look at how people are doing things in the cloud as they're evolving to cloud strategies, these data lake strategies where you sort of drop data in a place are coupled with service bus type of or a data bus type of strategies, things like Apache Kafka that are, you know, flowing data from sources and bringing it to destinations. So there's that interface and that integration of what used to be the old information bus kind of ideas with this data lake idea. And so we're getting this large amalgam of moving data, stored data, and it is centralizing, and that's great. But in terms of thinking about cataloging that data, in terms of thinking about access control and protection for that data, I think we're still in the early days. So I'll give you a simple example. Imagine you do have data coming from a bunch of IoT devices and it's landing in the data lake. And you also have data coming from, let's say, point of sale and other kind of customer-facing data that's landing in the data lake. When it first comes in, you may actually not know which files contain what information. So that data hasn't even been parsed yet and put into structures where you could imagine saying things like, we're not allowed to show personally identifiable information, because we don't know where that information is in those files yet. We don't even know if those files have that information. And so there's this kind of like the freedom that we have to land data is terrific, but the ability to know what's there and know how to manage it is, I think, still an evolving challenge for the industry. And we're seeing both private companies as well as the cloud vendors try to tackle questions of data cataloging, data profiling, and of course the stuff we do at Trifecta, data cleaning and wrangling. Those are all happening, but the pieces are coming together. And I think this data management story is very different than what we saw back in the enterprise with the old iron kinds of companies.
Makes sense. I do want to bring my co-host back in because they're chomping at the bit here. I think I'll throw it to Curtis first. Curtis?
You know, it's interesting, Joe, that you mentioned the old iron companies, because I came into the world of database back when we were still taught ISAM and VSAM. This was pre-SQL days. And as we've been talking about, you know, in other stories here on TWiET, there are still lots of companies out there, lots of organizations who have data in these very old data structures. I have trouble picturing someone making a tweak to their COBOL application to get it to deal gracefully with Hadoop and data lakes and these other new structures. So for companies like that, especially for companies that have lots and lots of historical data, is the right solution for them to look at simply living with having multiple data types, multiple data structures, and deal with it and figure out how to deal with it gracefully? Or are you going to be able to help them migrate everything ultimately into the modern, more performance-oriented data structures?
Yeah, that's great. I mean, the answer's got to be yes and with all these kinds of things. You don't turn off database systems. I mean, that's just what you're seeing there as you talk about live COBOL systems out in the wild. We probably all saw the news reports recently about how state of New Jersey was trying to find COBOL programmers to help them because of COVID-19. These systems add value to organizations, and many of them are core to businesses, whether it's, you know, old mainframes from, you know, the 60s that you're alluding to. Those are less common. But we see lots of 80s and 90s tech that's critical to companies. You know, my favorite example is the Teradata data warehouse software. Lots of value locked up in that software inside of companies, and, you know, a rich history of technology in those products. So we're not going to turn that stuff off overnight. It's adding value to businesses. And in many cases, there's no reason to migrate that stuff. The thing to keep in mind is that the data we generate each year is exponentiating, which means that next year there'll be twice as much data generated as we've had, like, over the whole history of computing. Okay, so that doesn't mean we're going to turn off the old stuff, but boy, we better start thinking about the new stuff differently. And so I think for most businesses, that's a reality. Now, sometimes you do want to start migrating to the cloud, and there's certainly interesting technologies to do that, including technologies that will take full application stacks off of something like Teradata and bring them into a cloud database like a Microsoft Azure database. So these things can be done, and there's offerings to do it, and I think we'll see more of that over time. But I'm a big advocate. You know, my first job was at IBM, too. I go back. Big advocate of if it ain't broke, don't fix it. There are things that you just want to leave running and maintain them.
You know, speaking of leaving things running and maintaining them, I got a question again. You know, for those of us who have been in the industry for a while, retraining becomes a huge issue. We know that we've got to keep up with technology, but you know, it's painful every time it happens. So when you look at these companies, when you see the data, when you see the people dealing with the data, do you see the biggest struggle, the biggest challenge, let's say, being on the technology side, putting together the connectors to make everything work, or on the human factor side, just helping people shift their expertise from an old way of thinking about data into these new frameworks and technologies?
Yeah, you know, you alluded to ISAM earlier, and funny enough, you know, so this is IBM indexing technology from the 60s. When we teach database systems, modern database systems at Berkeley, we start by showing them ISAM. And we say, look how simple that is, right? Here's what's missing from it. And then we introduce 70s technology, and then we introduce 80s technology. But the idea of that education is, although the ideas evolve, the core kind of conceptual notions that you need, are a lot of them last for decades and are critical. And that if you know those, you'll translate from tech stack to tech stack. One of those that, you know, is making a huge comeback is SQL. Most of the workload, you know, my colleagues at Berkeley founded Databricks and the Apache Spark project. So very successful big data infrastructure. Most of their workload comes from their SQL interface, from Spark SQL. And you look at the rise of Snowflake and the cloud vendors' databases as well. So this resurgence in SQL is not it's not one of these things where there was a better technology. In fact, the SQL interface was fine. So you do need to be learning new things and new skills. Sometimes the languages stay the same. Sometimes the languages change, but you just need to learn a new thing. And I would say for most of the folks I'm working with, you know, both in the Silicon Valley tech space, but also at customers, you know, at banks and at insurance companies, healthcare providers, people are remarkably resilient at learning new technologies, particularly around core IT function. I think when you start getting really new ideas at the table, so for instance, the integration of machine learning into people's enterprises, where you need more expertise on the technology, that's a bigger shift because those are genuinely new technologies. In fact, they're unproven in many cases, technologies that we're trying to deploy. But when we look at the shifts from, say, data management the way it was done in Oracle to data management the way it's done in Snowflake, a lot of the principles and even interfaces persist. So I'm quite confident that if you're out there working in tech and you're an IT person, you have the skills you need to transition to those new tools. And it's just a matter of kind of getting up and doing it and getting your feet wet.
Hey, Joel, I've been around almost as long as Curtis. And I'm actually looking at using, you know, a lot of people using the cloud as a migration tool. But one of the things that I've been really worried about is, you know, I got my early introduction to database was actually Adabase, for goodness sakes. And the reality is, you know, I've seen several projects where people have just said, okay, we'll integrate the old data sources, and now there's no more expertise left to migrate. Yeah. Is this one of those hidden oops we might want to keep in mind as we move forward?
I love that question. And I love the way it dovetails with the previous one, because fundamentally, that is not a tech question. That is a corporate collective wisdom question. A lot of times, the reason it's hard to migrate data is we don't remember what the data is about, right? We don't remember what the fields represent. We don't remember what the code book was. And those are things that can be hard to extract from the records because there may be none. And this is a place where I think standard practice is still very poor. We're not good at metadata. We're not good at recording what the data is about and documenting it. We don't have very good tooling for that either. Despite decades of tools that have been built for master data management and other such things, realistically, when you look at most projects, the data is poorly documented. The software is better documented, actually, but still not great. The organizational wisdom that has to do with data curation is something that everybody's still struggling with. Technology doesn't necessarily help with that, but we are, for instance, at Berkeley working on research to try to help with that. So the hope is that with better interfaces, with some AI crawling and mining for information, you can help make it less burdensome for people to document data in ways that's reusable. But I will tell you, that is actually a very hard problem. You know, when you think about hard AI problems, data cataloging, data documentation, metadata, those are actually very hard problems.
Yeah, and I still remember sitting in a lecture hall, and Grace Hopper is handing me a nanosecond. And that was actually one of the things she talked about. She says the original intent was COBOL would be self-documenting, and yeah. We all know how well that worked.
Yeah.
Right at the very beginning in my undergrad, it was a problem. Metadata. And I keep hoping it'll change, and, you know, maybe it will. But let's start closing up. Lou's going to ask you a few more, things. But basically, we're going to start talking about where can people go and get more information about Trifacta.
That's right. Thank you. Yeah, thanks, Joe, for being here. We're running a little bit low on time. I'll give you a chance to tell the folks at home where they can find Trifacta, where you can try more about Trifacta, and maybe get started wrangling their data.
Yeah. Well, Trifacta is primarily a cloud-based service, so you can just go try it. If you go to cloud.trifacta.com, you can sign up and get to work. You can load up a CSV or a Microsoft Excel spreadsheet, or you can connect to data in the cloud, and you can have a look at what you got in your files if you've never seen that data before, and you can start cleaning it up. Trifacta is also the vendor of Google Cloud Data Prep by Trifacta. So if you're a Google Cloud user, go on the left of your cloud console and look for Data Prep. That's Trifacta as well, and it provides quite a bit of access to the Google data sources. And we have a more advanced version for enterprise users as well. So I encourage you to play with it. One thing that was alluded to earlier in the broadcast is I've been putting out some videos called The Data School with Professor Joe Hellerstein. If you Google for that, Data School videos are accessible, quick intros to some of the concepts of why is data wrangling a problem and how is technology available to make it something that anybody can do. So I'd encourage you to have a look at those. They're short, they're fun, and they're just a quick introduction to the concepts.
Well, folks, you've done it again. You've sat through another hour of the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe. So you should stop resisting actually playing us during your virtual social hours. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to my co-host, starting with our very own Mr. Brian Chi. Chibert, what's going on for you this coming week, and where can people find you?
You're welcome to drop me a line. I'm ADVNETLAB, Advanced Net Lab, on Twitter. I am also Chebert, spelled C-H-E-E-B-E-R-T. We had a Dilbert theme going in my lab at twit.tv. Or better yet, why don't you send something to twiet at twit.tv, and that'll hit all the hosts. And as for what am I doing, I am going to try and get rid of this cold, I hope, and maybe do a little bit more packing. And I'm actually seriously thinking I'm going to try and get SparkleCam running on my rig at home and graduate from a inexpensive Logitech webcam up to a DSLR for my broadcasts.
Fantastic, fantastic. We'll feel better. Well, we also have to think of Mr. Curtis Franklin. He's a senior editor at Dark Reading. Curtis, what's going on with you in the coming week, and where can people find you and all your work?
Well, as always, you can find me and my work at Dark Reading and over at the edge of Dark Reading. Got lots of interesting stuff coming up. We're playing with the idea of some best practices stories. I'm talking to people about some case studies, looking at exactly what they did during security incidents. Lots of fun stuff coming up, as well as more and more virtual events. There are going to be a lot of those, both on Dark Reading and, of course, leading up to Black Hat Online. So look me up over there. You can always contact me or follow what I'm doing down here at KG4GWA on Twitter or Kurt.Franklin at Instagram. Look forward to seeing you all in any of those places.
Thanks, guys, for being here. Well, folks, we also have to thank you as well. You're the person who drops in each and every week to watch and to listen to our show to get your enterprise goodness. We want to make it easy for you to watch and listen and catch up on your enterprise news. So go out right now to our show page, twit.tv/twiet. There you'll find all the amazing back episodes, the show notes, the co-host information, the guest information, and links to the stories we do during the show. But more importantly, next to those videos, you'll get those helpful subscribe and download links. Go ahead, support the show by getting your audio version, your video version, your HD video version of your choice. Listen on any one of your devices or any one of your podcast applications. We're on every one of those. It's the best way to stay on top of your enterprise and IT news, so you might as well go ahead and subscribe. Now, after you subscribe, you can impress your friends, your family, by giving them the gift of Twiet. That's right. Definitely subscribe and then give a gift. Now, if you already subscribed, you can, and you're available during the day at 1:30 p.m. Pacific on Fridays, we do the show live. You can find that live at live.twit.tv. Come see how the show is run, the behind the scenes, how the pizza is made, the banter, and all the fun at live.twit.tv. Now, if you're going to watch the show live, we have a really great chat room as well. Live questions, live discussions, some really great characters in there at irc.twit.tv. So if you're going to watch it live, you might as well jump into the chat room live as well. Now, if you can't be part of the live and you just want to subscribe and listen to the news, but also be part of the discussions as well, the community, we have a really great community out there as well. It's actually behind me. It's very blurry, but it's twit.community. Yeah, you go ahead and twit.community right now. You can find all the hosts are out there, show content, guests, discussion information, people just discussing technology and chatter about all things current and things that are going on. It's really a great place to go to have really great discussions. So go ahead and check out right now, twit.community. Community. Remember, you can always follow me, twitter.com/LouMM. There I post all my enterprise tidbits, of course, conversations with good people like you, and of course, all the work that I do at Microsoft during my work week. And don't forget, Microsoft Build next week. That's right. Make sure you sign up. It's free to sign up. Really some great content that's going on. In fact, a couple of my sessions are already booked out. So if we have some spaces, we'll let more people in. But definitely check that out, build.microsoft.com. I also want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to Leo and Lisa. They continue to support us each and every week to This Week in Enterprise Tech, and we couldn't do the show without them. So thank you for all their support. And of course, I also want to thank all the engineers and all the staff at Twit. They really have supported us over the years, and we really thank them. Of course, we have to thank Mr. Brian Chee one more time. He's our not only our co-host, but he's also our tireless producer as well. He does all the bookings and the plannings for the show, and we really couldn't do this show without him. So thanks again, Cheebert, for all your support, sir. And before we sign out, we have to thank our TD for today, Jeff. Jeff, thank you so much, man, for being here. How are things going at behind the scenes at Twit?
Things are going pretty good. Still very, very quiet here. Our controller was able to come back and work in her office today, so that's good to gradually see people start coming back. But we're still taking this very serious, as everybody should be, and just, you know, right, figure out what works for them and what works for the community around them. But great show today, guys. Some really awesome information, great guest, and always educational.
Thank you, sir. Well, hopefully every show things keep getting better. And until next time, I'm Louis Maresca, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.
Hi, I'm Jason Howell, host of All About Android, where each week I'm joined by Ron Richards, Florence Ion, and a rotating crew of Android journalists, developers, and enthusiasts, where we talk about the latest news, hardware, and apps for the Android faithful. You can subscribe by going to twit.tv/AAA or find the show in your podcatcher of choice. That's All About Android.